Okay, this is the home stretch. We've been talking up to now about process-related things, but I want to spend some time on formulation-related things, points to consider, mostly. We've mentioned critical quality attributes early yesterday. I'll run through them again without spending a lot of time on them. Of course, sterility, endotoxins, extraneous particulate matter. This is all USP stuff. Complete or at least consistent recovery of activity, reconstitution. Then there are some other quality attributes that may be critical or may not, depending on the injectable route of administration. Things like isotonicity, you know, the same osmotic concentration as normal plasma, physiological pH. You don't see preservatives very often in freeze-dried products, but there are a few out there. You need to be aware of that. But the idea of this is for things like intramuscular injection, subcutaneous, intravenous, whether it's a bolus or infusion. It's always nice to be isotonic, always nice to be at physiological pH. But it doesn't really matter. It really matters when you talk about critical routes like into the spinal cord, any part of the brain, any part of the eye, where it really becomes critical to have isotonic and physiological pH and freedom from preservatives. So the point of all this is that you do need to keep the intended route of administration in mind. Pre-formulation considerations. Before you ever get a beaker wet and make any trial lots, you have to consider what's the anticipated dose. You know, when we have a potential client project, one of the things we want to do is collect all the available information that would bear on product and process development. And, you know, sometimes potential clients are a little reluctant to give it because they don't think it's complete enough or isn't professional looking enough. You know, we really don't care. We just like to know to have them get their cards on the table as far as what they know. And of course, one of the first things we ask is what's the anticipated dose? And commonly they don't know yet. But that's a big deal because it varies all over the place. In some cases, I showed you a vial of vancomycin yesterday. The formulation is just drug. There's nothing else there. And that's the intended dose of the vial is the weight of the freeze-dried solid. If you consider a product like Factor VIII that hemophiliacs use, there's only a few micrograms of Factor VIII in that vial. Most of it is inactive ingredients, bulking agents, protectants, and the API itself is, in terms of freeze drying, is just kind of along for the ride. So you need to know where you are in terms of the dose and how big a part of the total amount of freeze dried solid that's going to be. Chemical and physical stability. Unless there were a chemical or physical stability issue, you wouldn't be freeze drying it in the first place. Your first choice is a ready to use aqueous solution. It's more convenient to, administer. But you need to know, you know, if it's chemically unstable, how unstable is it? Do you have to worry about the degradation that takes place between formulation and sterile filtration and any holding step and filling and getting it into the freeze dryer? I've had a few of those cases over the years. Generally not a problem, but you need to know. Physical stability basically refers to the tendency of perhaps some component to precipitate out of a formulation, again, over the time course of manufacture, filling, holding, and so forth. Solubility, of course. But for weak acids and bases, solubility will be a function of pH. I include vapor pressure for the sake of completeness. It's rarely a problem. In some injectable vitamin formulations, if it contains niacinamide, that has enough vapor pressure, not really to lose it during freeze drying, but it would prevent you from doing residual moisture determination by loss on drying. You'd get artificial high values because of sublimation of a component of the formulation. Ibuprofen has a significant vapor pressure, you know, enough that you need to at least be aware of it. As I said, not commonly an issue. I won't spend much time on this. It's just kind of a rundown for different routes of administration about the amount that you would typically inject and whether isotonicity and physiological pH would really be considered a critical quality attribute. It's a good guideline regarding putting a formulation together to keep it as simple as you can. You know, don't include anything without a clearly stated rationale. Preferably have both a rationale and supportive data, and don't forget to document this in a development history summary. Development history documents are really valuable, and there are all too many products out there for which no development history is available. Okay, excipients and freeze-dried products, buffers, yes. Bulking agents, that's just to provide enough mass. For example, I mentioned factor 8. You're not gonna freeze dry that as a single component. There's too little of it. It wouldn't stay in a vial during freeze drying. So this is bulking agents. It is intended to provide a matrix that the API is dispersed within. It may be simply a bulking agent to provide bulk. Or it can be a stabilizer as well. They can serve both purposes. Things like, you know, disaccharides like sucrose, trehalose, sometimes lactose. HSA refers to human serum albumin, pretty good stabilizer. People stayed away from that for years because of concern over disease transmission, but there is recombinant human serum albumin available now that sort of makes that concern go away. Tonicity modifier, in other words, to get the osmotic concentration the same as normal human physiological fluids, mostly it's sodium chloride. Sometimes you'll see potassium chloride. Surfactants are very commonly used in protein formulations, things like polysorbate 20 and 80, poloxamer less commonly. Preservatives only rarely used. There's no rule. I've said that it's a good guideline to keep the formulation as simple as you can. There's no rule that says you have to have a buffer there. And more is not necessarily better. Keep in mind that many times the API will be a weak acid or a weak base, and it can be its own buffer. Proteins, you know, monoclonal antibodies and antibody drug conjugates have significant buffer capacity, and they can act as their own buffer. And don't forget that buffers in frozen systems can be paradoxical. What I mean by that is that you can, in some situations, get pH swings that are higher in a buffered, in a system containing a buffer than one that doesn't have a buffer at all. The most common example is sodium phosphate. But this is just a list of buffers in approved products. It's not complete, but it's pretty much complete. I mention that because if you worry about job security, you don't want to use an excipient in a formulation you're developing that's never been used in an approved product. You know, you don't want to cause unnecessary delays in approval. So try to use something that's currently used in a marketed product. This is an example of a pH shift associated with freezing. This is just a solution of sodium phosphate buffer, I think at pH 7.4, and we put a drop or two of one of these universal indicators where it changes color depending on the pH. This is the pre-frozen system. This is the that same material that's been put in the freezing compartment of a refrigerator overnight. Notice how it turns red. That's about a three pH unit shift. So sodium phosphate is the most common buffer in injectable products, but it's also the one that's most subject to these kinds of pH shifts associated with freezing. This is a citrate buffer. Again, same idea. It's just less of a pH shift. And this is a Tris buffer. No real pH shift that we can tell. This isn't a highly precise or accurate measurement of pH. What it is a good visual indicator of whether you're getting an observable pH shift. It's easy to do, and you can get useful information from that. Again, just a drop of indicator. Freeze it and see how the color responds. There is a common point of view that if you've got sodium phosphate in a formulation, that it will shift. That's not necessarily true. The idea behind the pH shift, I mentioned it yesterday, is you have an equilibrium between the dibasic and the monobasic buffer species. The dibasic is less soluble. It's going to precipitate first in a freezing system. You disturb the equilibrium shifts and drives the pH down. That is all triggered by the dibasic buffer salt precipitating, okay? Crystallizing from that system. If you've got other things there that can interfere with that crystallization, it may not take place at all. It depends on the relative amount of buffer compared to the other things that are there. So again, just because you've got a sodium phosphate buffer there doesn't mean that you're going to get a pH shift when it freezes. I've already said that the need for a bulking agent depends on the dose of the drug. Plenty of drug product molecules that where the formulation is just the API. You don't want the total concentration of dissolved solids to be either too high or too low. If it's too low, you're going to tend to have more of a problem with powder ejection from the vial during freeze drying. You don't want that. You don't want it too high either. I showed you a kind of an exaggerated example yesterday of how a higher concentration can influence the morphology of the ice. It caused a shift from a dendritic morphology to a spherulitic morphology. And the reason you care about that is the very, very high resistance of the high concentration spherulitic ice morphology. But even so, even if that doesn't happen, you don't want the concentration too high, because the higher it gets, the higher the resistance of the dry product layer is going to be, and the more uncertain your control of product temperature will be during primary drying. Again, as you build up that resistance, you slow the sublimation rate. As you slow the sublimation rate, you get an increase in temperature, and that increase in temperature can give rise to uncertainty about keeping the temperature below a certain critical point. We think it's good practice to include both a crystalline and an amorphous bulking agent. In other words, something like a glycine or mannitol, and something like sucrose or trehalose, less commonly lactose. And then keep in mind that an amorphous excipient like a disaccharide can serve both functions. It's both a bulking agent and a stabilizer. This is a freeze-dried photo micrograph of a sucrose glycine protein formulation. I don't even remember what the protein is. Doesn't really matter. This is the freeze-dry microscope. Again, frozen, sublimation front. This material is all collapsed. This system was not annealed. And this is at a very low temperature, I think minus 45 or so. A troublesome formulation to freeze-dry. And if we take the same thing and anneal it, in this case, we're crystallizing out the glycine. Again, frozen material, sublimation front. This is the partially dried material. You can see the crystals of glycine there. I showed you an example earlier this morning of microcollapse, where we have amorphous material developing a Swiss cheese kind of a look. That's microcollapse because it's collapse taking place, but you have to have a pretty high-powered microscope to see it. Another form of microcollapse is this, where there's the TG prime of this time. This was actually quite low. It was in the around minus 40. It would certainly be troublesome. But when we anneal this material, we get retention. We get a pharmaceutically acceptable product, even at fairly aggressive temperatures. The reason for that is that we do have collapse going on. But the collapse is not gross collapse. It's collapsing around this. Think of it as a scaffold or a lattice work of solid material. So this is the kind of collapse of microcollapse that occurs when you have a crystalline material there that maintains the whole structure intact, even though you have collapse taking place on a micro scale. And as I said yesterday, as long as critical quality attributes are met, you don't care whether it's collapsing on a micro scale. And it's why it's good practice, I think, to include both an amorphous agent as a protectant and a crystallizing agent as, I think of it as a mechanical stabilizer of the cake and something that really improves the process robustness and visual appearance, if nothing else, of the freeze-dried product. A little bit about mannitol. It's of all bulking agents, mannitol is the most common. Has very favorable freeze-drying properties with some exceptions. I don't know whether you've encountered vial breakage problems. We have periodically. And it's most common in mannitol-based formulations. Mannitol does exhibit polymorphism. There's three forms of the anhydrate. We've never found that that matters. What the crystal form of mannitol we do worry about is mannitol hydrate, where that hydrate can be in the initially freeze-dried product, but over storage, the water of hydration can be released and increase the effective residual moisture content of that product. So we do pay attention to mannitol hydrate. And of course, the rate of freezing can affect the extent of mannitol crystallization in the freeze-dried product. And again, annealing step may be a good idea just to promote crystallization of the mannitol. This is some examples of vial breakage. This is the most common, I think. We call it lensing, where the bottom of the vial just shears away from the body. But it also can, this is a molded vial where they look more like somebody had whacked them with a hammer. Both take place. Again, I think this is the most common one. And there are, the reason you care about this is that, one, it can really hurt your yield. And maybe more importantly than that, particularly if you're dealing with cytotoxic agents, potentially hazardous materials, you've got a mess to clean up. And it's a mess to clean up that you really have to worry about operator protection against exposure by this, considering you've got broken vials and powder scattered all over a freeze dryer. The other thing about vial breakage that's happened in our world is where you have a piece of broken glass that somebody didn't get cleaned out, and you compress the shelves together. Actually, you compress the shelves together during the, as a part of the clean in place, sterilize in place system. We've had pieces of broken glass actually puncture a hole in the shelf. Those shelves in modern freeze dryers are a lot thinner and a lot more fragile than most people think they are. Especially when they've gone to more environmentally friendly refrigerants that maybe aren't as efficient. One of the things that freeze dryer manufacturers have done is that they've decreased the overall thermal mass of the shelf stack, and they've adopted different techniques. They've gone from traditional welding to what they call dry brazing. I'm not quite sure what that is, but they've made these changes to make the shelf stack lighter, just to improve the efficiency. But they've also made them more fragile, so that and as I've seen this myself, where just a piece of broken glass poked a hole in the freeze dryer shelf. There are a bunch of contributing factors to vial breakage and freeze drying. The relative fill volume, the more you fill it, the higher the extent's going to be. This is a rough rule of thumb. You want to keep the volume of fill to no more than about 30% of the overflow capacity of a vial. You never want to fill it too full. The relative amount of, in this case, mannitol certainly matters. The heel radius of the vial, the geometry, it's the radius of curvature as you go from the wall of the vial to the bottom. The more gradual the curvature, the less opportunity is for the stress to be localized at a specific point in the heel radius, and the less likely it is to shear out or cause this lensing. And then thermal history of freezing matters. Some nice work been done a few years ago by a gentleman named Yinka Williams. I forget where he was at the time. But he found that he had some success by incorporating a pause during the freezing step. In other words, ramp down to minus 16 or minus 17, hold it for a while. I think he's giving the mannitol a time to crystallize when the system is still mostly fluid and will move around. So that's another avenue that can be explored. There's a lot that's not known about the interaction between the formulation and the inner surface of the glass. We talked about that yesterday in terms of cake cracking, shrinkage that's not associated with collapse of a material. But I think it's the these mannitol formulations, for whatever reason, they seem to adhere very tightly to the inner wall of a vial. And I think a factor we have to consider in vial breakage is that with the mannitol crystallizes, it forms a metastable glass, and then with the addition of a little thermal energy, it crystallizes. And when that happens, the water that was associated with the mannitol crystallizes before, and the cake expands. If it's stuck to the side walls of the container, it's got nowhere to go. And the give, rather than being in the frozen material, is in the vial itself, where you're not going to see vial breakage from formulations that don't stick much. I don't think you'd ever see vial breakage in, for example, a top lyovial. We talked about that last night. It's a the inner surface of the vial is hydrophobic. I can't imagine that ever happening. Also, you never get fogging in that kind of a vial. So there's a lot that has to do with interaction between inner surface of the container and the formulation itself that we still don't know much about. Added salts. You need to keep them to a minimum, okay? If it needs to be isotonic, then you probably need to add a salt, but more is not necessarily better. The reason is they tend to decrease the collapse temperature of the formulation and make it less robust. It can inhibit crystallization of formulation components that you want to crystallize. Also, we talked about the increased ionic strength associated with freeze concentration. That can cause damage to biologicals, protein aggregation, and related things. This is just an example of the effect of increasing sodium chloride concentration on the TG prime. I think this is lactose. This is with no salt added. Notice that it's right around minus 30. And I think we've made stepwise increases up to about 2% sodium chloride. But look what we've done to the TG prime. Now, if we are assuming that the TG prime is predictive of collapse temperature, we've gone from a system that's relatively easy to freeze dry to one that's relatively difficult to freeze dry, especially after worry about scale up. We're about minus 45 degrees there. That is bound to be a troublesome formulation. So again, if you have to add salt to a formulation, don't add any more than you really need to. Some special considerations with freeze-dried proteins. It's a big part of our total portfolio, and probably just a reflection of development activity in the pharmaceutical world in general. I'm talking about monoclonal antibodies and antibody drug conjugates. There's a tremendous amount of work there and an accumulating body of clinical success as well. What makes them different from small molecules? Well, quite a bit. Both the short-term and long-term stabilities can be very strongly affected by small changes in the composition of the formulation. Generally speaking, we need some kind of a stabilizer, a disaccharide, human serum albumin, or something like that. The integrity of the protein can be affected by differences in the thermal history of freezing, where you don't really see that in the small molecule world, with only one or two exceptions that I can think of. Long-term stability can be affected significantly by what might seem like very small differences in the residual moisture level in that product. So you probably need to focus more on what is the dependence of the drug product stability on residual moisture level. Inclusion of a surfactant is generally considered good formulation practice. I mentioned factor 8 as an example, but for any product where you have the amount of protein is at a very low concentration, the more you have to worry about loss of protein during processing, sticking to solastic tubing, sticking to filters, sticking to gaskets. And as a general principle, you can minimize that adsorptive loss by including a surfactant in the formulation, because it's going to compete for adhesion to those surfaces with the protein. You don't mind if you lose a little bit of surfactant, but you mind very much if you lose a little bit of protein. We talked about that a little bit yesterday when Liz was here about adsorption of protein at the ice freeze concentrate interface as a mechanism for loss of protein integrity. Yes.
Let's say you don't have a protein, but you have like a polymer or like a nanoparticle. Could freeze drying potentially affect the morphology or if you have a crystallinity of that material?
Well, you're talking about polymers or
nanoparticles or some other macromolecular system, maybe other than a protein. Because I'm assuming the protein, the problem with proteins is that could unfold or denature.
Exactly.
What about larger systems that self-assemble?
Yeah, liposomes would be an example, or nanoparticles would be a problem. And the same kind, at least with liposomes, the same general considerations apply in the sense that the disaccharides can be good stabilizers for liposomes. And I'm sure that the mechanism of stabilization is probably different. In the case of nanoparticles, where you've got basically a nano suspension, one of the big problems there is that the particles are jammed together by the freeze concentration process. Lipid emulsions are an example as well, where you can break that emulsion by freeze concentration because you force the lipid particles together to such extent that it's not reversible. They coalesce and they stay coalesced. Ultimately, you can break an emulsion. And it doesn't even take freeze drying, just freeze thawing can do that. So yeah, the same kinds of considerations apply. So the idea behind this is the protein tends to adsorb at the ice freeze concentrate interface and partly unfold. It's mostly reversible upon freeze thawing, but if you freeze it and then you pull out the water, the proteins are sometimes get stuck in an improperly folded configuration, and they don't refold when you rehydrate the material, leading typically to aggregation. And this mechanism can explain much of the phenomenology of freeze drying. It doesn't jump out at you from the literature, but a picture that evolves when you read enough articles on freeze drying of proteins is that if you have a higher concentration, you get better activity recovery. The idea there is that there's only so much ice to freeze concentrate interface that's there. As you increase the concentration, you're going to reach a point where it's all filled up, and any additional protein is not going to be at the interface. It's protected from the interface by all the other protein that's there. So as a general rule, you get better activity recovery at high concentration than you do at low concentration. Perhaps the sensitivity to thermal history of freezing because of the influence of thermal history on relative size of ice crystals and area that's available for proteins to adsorb too. And then the stabilizing influence of surfactants simply because they're going to compete with the protein for occupancy of that ice to freeze concentrate interface. So something to keep in mind. We do a lot of formulation screening studies that's kind of represented in this slide where we're looking at percent recovery with no excipient. We get for this protein, with no excipient, no stabilizer, we get no activity at the end. And then glycine, sucrose by itself, sucrose and sodium chloride, sucrose, glycine, sodium chloride. The idea is that this is the short-term stability, the stability against damage caused by the freeze-drying process itself. So we sort of start there. And of course, we extend this by a lot. But it's just an example of systematically varying the formulation composition and seeing the influence on resulting activity recovery. As I said, we do an awful lot of this as a part of development plans. This is an example of influence of thermal history of freezing on recovery. We use lactate dehydrogenase. This is an old slide. I apologize for that. But there are three concentrations, 5, 25, and 50. Micrograms per mil, shown by these different bars. Okay, and we use different thermal histories of freezing. It's partly blocked out there. This is frozen very slowly at a half a degree a minute to minus 45 degrees. This one, we use liquid nitrogen. We basically flash froze this material. And this was put on a pre-cooled shelf at minus 45 degrees. You may remember yesterday I talked about Alan McKenzie's idea of shelf freezing as being paradoxical. Slow is fast and fast is slow. Well, certainly the fastest freezing issue is if you just quench freeze it in liquid nitrogen, and it's, we get systematically the lowest recovery. Notice for each of these, the higher concentration, the better. That has to do with what I just said about concentration dependence of activity recovery. But you think that if this is the fastest freezing, it might be easy to think that the second fastest freezing is if we put it on a pre-cooled shelf, and the slowest is if we had a very slow ramp rate. But in fact, there's not a huge difference, but it is a significant difference, is that is if this activity recovery is determined by the effective freezing rate, the effective freezing rate is slower by putting filled vials on a shelf that's already been pre-cooled to minus 45. Again, the idea is you form ice crystals in the bottom of the depth of fill before the top of the depth of fill, that volume of fill, has even had a chance to cool off much. You're essentially seeding it with ice, and you get a minimum amount of supercooling and effectively a slower cooling rate. So again, it's experimental evidence that there's some validity to the slow is fast and fast is slow paradox. This is just product temperature. Loaded at room temperature, decreased at 10 degrees per hour, and we get what you've already looked like. Well, it will look somewhere between 11 and maybe 15 degrees of supercooling. This is with the vials placed directly on the shelves. We don't really see an exotherm, probably because we get ice formed relatively quickly. And it was probably formed at a place where there's no thermocouple, so we don't really pick up that exotherm. Again, probably indicative of an effectively slower freezing rate. This is an undergrad student project, but basically what she did was try to vary the amount of supercooling by any means that she could, by putting a thermocouple inside the vial, thermocouples outside the vial. She used an ice nucleating protein in one case. Just it only takes a little bit to minimize the amount of supercooling. So she created a pretty big range and extensive supercooling, carried out the freeze-dry process, and then measured the activity recovery of that protein. This is, of course, with an older LioStar, and this is what she got. This is the extent of supercooling on this axis and activity recovery. Now, there's a lot of scatter in the data because of variability in the assay, but there's a clear trend toward lower activity recovery the higher the extent of supercooling. And again, stuff like this is good motivation for getting better control of the freezing process. It's important to characterize the freeze-dried product. A lot of people miss that. Thermal analysis is really useful to determine the glass transition of a solid. How is the glass transition temperature affected by increased residual moisture? If we're dealing with crystalline material, are there different crystal forms available? Does it exhibit polymorphism? And we can confirm that with things like with X-ray diffraction. Small differences in formulation composition can significantly affect the glass transition temperature of a solid. This example is trehalose by itself, trehalose with 10% mannitol. Again, notice that trehalose by itself has a TG of around 100 degrees. You'd expect that to be pretty stable at any accelerated storage temperature. But with 10% mannitol, it's down considerably. 20% mannitol, down even more. 30% mannitol. Now we're around 50 degrees or so, where we would have to be concerned about physical stability of the drug product when you're doing stressed stability testing. Of course, if you use more than about 30% mannitol, there's enough mannitol there that it's going to crystallize itself, and that trend then changes. But again, it's just an illustration of how changing the formulation composition can change the character of the freeze-dried solid a great deal. this is just a further illustration of that. This is a series of sugars, maltose, if you can't read it, maltose, sucrose, trehalose, lactose, raffinose. They have a big range of glass transition temperatures. Trehalose of around 100. Sucrose probably has the lowest glass transition temperature. But if we put these under stressed conditions, we find that the cake shrinks and they collapse in rank order, as you would expect with their glass transition temperature. And this is just a bit more in time, longer exposure time, showing more complete collapse of these materials. The reason you care about this, other than just looking bad, is that in order for sucrose or any disaccharide to be effective as a stabilizer of a protein, it has to remain amorphous. And what we find is that when this system, a sucrose-based system, collapses, the sucrose tends to crystallize. And when the sucrose crystallizes, it's not available as a protectant anymore. And the result on the protein, if we're talking about a protein, is not going to be a good thing. This is an example of that, where we're looking at four different storage temperatures of a glass system that has it's a sucrose glycine formulation. TG of only 34 degrees. 20 degrees, you get a very real, essentially no loss of activity. More loss at 30, and faster loss up to this point, both 40 and 50. At this point, the activity recovery goes down to zero. And of course, that's because the product collapsed, the sucrose crystallized, protective activity is lost, and protein activity is lost too. Beware of the tendency of components of the formulation to crystallize during storage. This is for a mannitol. This is an X-ray diffractogram showing amorphous material right out of the freeze dryer. This is after, 3 weeks and 5 weeks storage at 40 degrees. What we have is mannitol crystallizing from that formulation. Why do you care about that? We think you have to care about it because when the mannitol crystallizes, it crystallizes as an anhydrate, and it causes a redistribution of residual moisture. In other words, the residual moisture in the product that was previously associated with the mannitol is not associated with the mannitol anymore. So the residual moisture level in the rest of the amorphous material where the drug is going to increase. And that can have negative impact on stability. So we like to include in a stability program looking periodically at the X-ray diffractogram of the freeze-dried solid. Okay, this has to do with establishing residual moisture specifications. And I contrast a traditional approach to our view of a quality by design approach that pertains to establishing residual moisture specifications. It's been common practice, it still is common practice, to run trial batches during development and test for residual moisture to determine the process capability. Let's say we run a bunch of trial batches and we find that we consistently get below 1% residual moisture. That kind of becomes a working target value. We never test to see whether 1% residual moisture is associated in any way with failure in the form of compromised drug product stability, for example. But we establish these residual moisture specification and we collect stability data, and before we know it, we have a 1% limit on residual moisture. Well, that's okay, but what if you have a lot that's 1.1% residual moisture? You don't have any data that says that product stability has not been compromised, so you're probably going to end up throwing it away. And I contrast that with, again, our conception of a quality by design approach, which is you look for the failure point. Measure how the stability of the drug product is affected by residual moisture level over a reasonably wide range of residual moisture. And again, you look for that edge of failure in establishing a residual moisture specification. And you also have a body of data that would allow you to make better decisions in the future if you do have an outlier batch that's higher than normal residual moisture level. We do that by thief sampling of the product during a development run, during a trial cycle. This is my colleague Lisa Hardwick taking samples. Are you familiar with thief samplers? I think most of you are. It's got an inner door that opens that's part of the door of the freeze dryer, an inner chamber there, and then an outer door. It's hooked up to a vacuum pump with a kind of a crude pressure gauge on it. The idea is that you pump down the chamber of this vapor lock. That allows you to open the inner door, reach in with this grabber that's got a trigger that opens these and closes these jaws. You then grab vials by the neck, pull them up and out, put it into this chamber, close the door, bleed off the vacuum that's been in here, open up the outer door and remove your sample. So you're able to remove a sample without disturbing the process, or at least without disturbing it too much. You're going to get little pressure spikes, but they really don't last long enough to make any difference. So then what we do is monitor the Pirani gauge, and when we get to the end of primary drying, which is right here, when the Pirani gauge gets to, it actually went below the capacitance manometer, we start taking samples, and then we make step changes in shelf temperature. You know, the only process variable that really influences residual moisture level versus time is shelf temperature, so it's pretty simple. So for every shelf temperature, we hold it for a while and remove more samples. And we might remove a total set of maybe 25 vials from a trial run. Then we measure we use near IR. This is a non-destructive method. It measures the near IR spectrum through the bottom of the vial. Then we do a calibration run against using Carl Fisher as a referee method. And so we get a data set that looks something like this, from the start of secondary drying around 4% down to well under 0.5%. So then we decide what residual moisture levels do we want to look at as far as looking at stressed stability. You know, we might be up here at the high end, a couple of intermediate, and we're always going to include the low end. So we've established this calibration curve, so we do another trial run, removing vials at these pre-selected points. We measure the residual moisture by near IR. We actually write the residual moisture level on the label of that vial, put those vials on stability at probably both 40 and 50 degrees, and in that way, we're able to establish the relationship between residual moisture and stability. And we might get, in this case, we looked at, six different sampling points. This was the average and the residual moisture range for each of those sampling points. And then we do stress stability testing. This was at 50 degrees. And of course, the earlier the sample, the higher the residual moisture, the less physically stable those vials are going to be. This covers the high range of over 4%. This isn't the whole set because this only goes down to 2.6. I think at lower residual moisture levels, there was no change. And this is what happens to the X-ray diffractogram. The black line is initial, and this is the X-ray diffractogram of a vial where the freeze-dried solid has shrunk down to a little pellet. And this is all corresponds to crystalline sucrose. And as a result of that, we get accelerated stability. We look at recon time, initially less than 30 seconds. In this vial, it's more than 3 minutes. So, something's going on there. 4% residual moisture, over 8% aggregate, over 4% fragment. Now, here's one that's also has a high reconstitution time, but a pretty normal level of both aggregate and fragment. It's probably because the sucrose has crystallized, but the protein maybe hasn't had time to aggregate in the solid state yet. You can't expect these processes to happen at the same time. It's going to happen sequentially. You get shrinkage, crystallization of the sucrose, and ultimately loss of protein activity in that sequence. Okay. So again, a fast reconstitution time, somewhat lower residual moisture and normal. So again, it's an example of the kind of information you can get by systematically looking at influence of residual moisture on drug product stability. Some general rules. More buffers, not better. Add salts only if you really need to. I mentioned fritinicity adjustment, but it also might be for solubility reasons. Try to maximize the TG prime. Crystallizing excipients such as glycine or mannitol can help as a physical stabilizer of the cake. It's a good idea to keep the protein concentration as high as practical. Pay attention to residual moisture level. Generally speaking, drier is better, but not always. There are examples of overdrying of proteins.